Hello and welcome to the Halifax Arts Podcast. My name's Jeremy Walker and as usual I'm joined by Judy Green and Steve Archer. And this month we'll be discussing Judy and Punch, Knives Out, Last Christmas, The Irishman and an assortment of Christmas films including Elf, The Grinch and various others that are being shown in December at Square Chapel Arts Centre. So my first film is the extremely interesting and very bizarre Judy and Punch, which is directed by Mira Fuchs and has Damon Herriman as Punch and Mia Wasikowska as Judy. And it's set in the town of Seaside, which, as we're told at the beginning, is nowhere near the sea. And it's about Judy and Punch, who obviously have a puppet show. And Punch is the master puppeteer. He's the best puppeteer in the world, or so we're told. But it soon becomes clear that Judy is the master puppeteer and looks after the baby and does all the other things that need to be done, including the business side of the puppet show in the local very grotty pub. And Punch spends most of his time drunk, or trying to get drunk. And the main entertainment of Seaside is the weekly stoning of people, which gets people very excited and worked up, and they bring their own stones. And it does veer towards Monty Python territory with stoning. But eventually, Judy tries to keep Punch on the right side and off the drink, but in the finish he falls off the wagon, gets extremely drunk and beats Judy up, and unfortunate things happen to the baby as well, which if you've ever seen a Punch and Judy show you'll realize. And it does include a dog and sausages, and she dreams about alligators as well. Or is it crocodiles? I think it's crocodiles.
Pass. And there should be a policeman in there somewhere.
Yeah, yes. And she runs away and goes to live with a group of outcasts in the woods and plots her revenge on Punch. But a lot of people have said that the film kind of runs out of steam towards the end. There's not enough to go around, but it's very bizarre. Very strange. Yep, Judy and Punch.
What's it meant to be? I wasn't sure whether it's meant to be a comedy, a drama, a sort of allegory of modern life.
It's a comedy drama. Well, it's a fairy tale allegory, which I always end up talking about these films, don't I?
You always choose them.
I really like them, yes. But it's a fairy tale. It's comedy fairy tale allegory. It's basically, a lot of people have said it's a bit like The Joker. It's a foundation story. It's another version of how Punch and Judy came about. This isn't how it came about, but it could have come about.
Well, the title Judy and Punch is very deliberate, isn't it?
Yes. Judy's in charge.
Judy is in charge. Yes. And I think it's interesting how we did laugh, perhaps when we were young, at the vicious cruelty in Punch and Judy.
It's appalling.
But because we laugh at it, we never really thought much about it translating into real life. And this film does exactly that, doesn't it?
Yes.
Translates what's in a child's version of Punch and Judy into reality.
Yes, and what happens to the baby is exactly what happens in the Punch and Judy shows, because Punch doesn't look after the baby. But when you actually see it in real life, it's absolutely horrendous. And it's kind of portrayed in this kind of slightly comic way, which it is in a Punch and Judy show, but it's which makes it worse. So, yeah.
I think a lot of the sort of children's traditional stories are very similar anyway, aren't they?
Like the Grimm fairy tales are appalling.
All of those, the little boy in the cage having his fingers chopped off. And there are some pretty horrific things if you actually look at them. And they're all, you know, it's a fairy tale, it's nice.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually an interesting take to bring it into the real world.
Yeah. A lot of people have said that they really, really wanted to like it, and it's a really bizarre and interesting film, but they didn't like it as much as they wanted to.
I mean, do we assume that because it's called Judy and Punch, that Judy gets her own back in any way?
Well, I don't think we can actually say that.
Or perhaps we can't say that until we've watched the film. No. I'm surmising because I haven't seen the film at the moment, but I just assumed from the title that it, you know, that Judy
revenge
is,
does
revenge
happen.
Is sweet.
Yes.
Or perhaps not sweet, but revenge is there.
There is a definite revenge. Well, very quickly, my second film is another film that's showing at Square Chapel, and it's called The Amber Light, which is all about whiskey. Which very seasonal. It's filmed by Adam Park, and a whiskey connoisseur called Dave Broom wanders around Scotland and talks to people about the new upsurge. Apparently there is an upsurge in micro whiskey distilleries in Scotland. And the film is really about Scottish culture and the way it intertwines with whiskey. And he interviews people like Ian Rankin and Alistair Gray, who talk a lot about how much whiskey they drink. There are a huge number of tiny distilleries apparently scattered all around Scotland that are blending it with various things. And if you're into whiskey, this is the film to see. And there's a lot of music in it as well.
Okay, it just sounded rather a thin premise for a feature film to me. It sounded like quite a nice, maybe half an hour documentary.
Well, it's kind of tour of Scotland and Scottish culture, really, but that includes Scottish music and whiskey. Lots
and if
of whiskey.
Ian Rankin's there, presumably a bit of
Edinburgh.
Okay.
Well, when I saw the trailer, the first thing I sort of thought was, how can you sustain this for more than about 15 or 20 minutes, as Judy's just mentioned? Because it seemed to be an interesting advert for whiskey. But I thought, well, what happens next?
I think it's kind of also a way into Scottish culture and talking about it. And instead of doing a tour of Scotland and all the wonderful things in Scotland, they're basing it on whiskey. I mean, you kind of would, wouldn't you?
So you wouldn't say it's got a narrative arc, to be pretentious?
No.
No. It's just a good random tour of Scotland.
It's a tour of Scotland, a tour of micro distilleries. But they also interview writers and artists who all seem to like whiskey.
So is it tourist board funded or something like that?
No, I think it's got funding from, Kickstarter.
Oh, okay.
It's got money from Kickstarter.
Right, so it's not specifically a Scottish...
No, but I'm sure the Scottish touring tourist board won't be...
won't be
unhappy,
no.
Right, we're going to take a short break from discussing the films to hear from some of the people who work and perform with Mind the Gap Theatre Company in Bradford and who are regular visitors to Halifax with their theatre productions.
I'm Bea. I'm Associate Artist in Theatre and Engagement at Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a theatre company based in Bradford in Manningham Mills, and we've been going for 31 years now. And over that 31 years, we've worked with a lot of people. The type of people we work with are people with learning disabilities. So we're a professional national and international touring theatre company who exclusively work with people with learning disabilities. And because of that, we run an academy so that local people in Yorkshire have a chance to develop their skills in the creative arts, in theatre and dance and music. We run a training programme that helps them learn and develop those skills over a period of time. So we have part-time courses that run one day a week, we have a full-time course that runs 4 days a week, and then we have a group of artists who are employed by the company to represent us and work in our shows and do lots of other very exciting things.
Hello, my name's Howard. I've been an artist now for 10 years. Mind the Gap has a special place in my heart because I go there every day and meet some fantastic people. People have helped me so much in my 10 years since I've been there, especially like Charlie and Joyce and of course Bea, helped me in my journey and which I'm very, very proud of because, it's such a great place to go to and you've got friends there who we can turn to if you've got problems because you've got your friends there who will listen.
Hello, I am Ewan and we came here for Halifax for taking over by B and some friends as well. And we done some routine like butterflies and titties.
Turns out we've been in Halifax quite a lot recently. It's a lovely place. We like it very much. That's why we keep coming back. So Halifax Square Chapel is one of our venue partners for our Engage and Staging Change work, which is where Mind the Gap has partnered with 6 venues across the country to try and sort of assist them to become more accessible for audiences, for participation, for workforce, for everything really, because Mind the Gap have a load of artists and nowhere for them to go sometimes, and they're really skilled in our building, but how do we match those skills with venues in other places? And the lovely Square Chapel has been very very good at being one of our sort of strongest and local closest to us partners. So in Halifax we have done Zara, which was the third part of our Daughters of Fortune project. Daughters of Fortune is a project about parents with learning disabilities, what happens to them, the assessment they have to go through when they become pregnant, which is quite an interesting and untold story. So we grabbed that story and we told it in lots of different ways to lots of different audiences to spread the word, really. So we had a forum theatre piece, we had a small scale theatre piece that toured around the country and did a stint in Edinburgh, and then we had Zara, which was a giant baby as tall as a double decker bus, and we planted our baby in Halifax Peace Hall and made quite a big impact, I think. And we did 2 shows over Easter weekend earlier this year in 2019, and had like audiences of between 1,500 and 2,000 people for each night, which was pretty impressive and something we've never done before. So we were super proud that we managed to get an audience that big for a story that's not told at all, if ever, and get them to listen and watch our wonderfully skilled artists tell those beautifully important stories.
Talking to Zara, I like to mention Zara because Zara was, like Bea's just said, a very big project for us to do. Everyone was so amazing, everybody, especially in Halifax, where we did it at the Peace, just outside here of the Peace Hall. You know, it was a fantastic, and my fellow bio the cleaners, they were absolutely amazing, they really were, and I couldn't thank them enough, and did the same in London, and London was very special.
We done well in the Peace Hall, that a bit. Zara pushed it, and it was about to sign Bridge Baby, and I was in the army, and for the army it's very, very hard, and very bit more strains a bit.
Hello, my name is Liam. I'm an artist at Mind the Gap, and I've been at Mind the Gap for 10 years now. Mind the Gap means so much to me because I love working with my friends, and they're not all of my friends, they're my inspirations, what shows they've done, like what my fellow colleague said about Zara, the biggest project. It was my, and I took up the leading role as a news reporter. And also, it's just been like a family to me. I can ever wish for. I'm also playing a lad called Alex. I work in Roswell's in Coronation Street. How I got the part was through a Breaking Through talent workshop. It was for casting, and I didn't know I was going to get it at first, because when they ran in Man the Gap, everyone couldn't stop looking at me, because when I was looking at them back, it felt like, do they know something or something? So as soon as they delivered the punchline, when they said, we would like to offer you as part as Alex, I thought, is this real? Please tell me this is real. And it was. And to me, I've always wanted to be on Coronation Street ever since I was a little boy, because my mum took me shopping when I was a little boy, and I used to read all the short books from the beginning to the end, and I couldn't. And then I was thinking, could I imagine to be on Coronation Street? I thought to myself when I did the workshop, I thought, okay, how did I do this?
Alright, so I've come to Halifax today to do a takeover and to show what we can do. And it's been really good working with different people and getting to know them. And yeah, I think we all can be proud of each other of what we've done.
So, moving on to our next film, The Irishman. We're only mentioning this briefly because it's featured not only in our arts centre, but on Netflix. So I'm sure many people will catch it one way or the other. This is, if you like, a follow-up to Goodfellas. It's an epic saga, a Scorsese epic saga of 3.5 hours, American organized crime. And the story is told by Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro, who is a World War II veteran. Now, the important thing about this is that he's been desensitized by his war experiences, and he's also used to following instructions to the letter. He's a hustler after the war and a hitman who might or might not have been involved in the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, the legendary union boss, in the 1970s. So we have De Niro hosting, if you like, the story of this film, with Al Pacino playing Hoffa and Joe Pesci playing De Niro's, that's Frank Sheeran in the film, playing his mentor. Joe Pesci, I remember from Goodfellas, when he didn't like a waiter when they were eating their food, so he got his gun out and shot him, which I thought was an interesting moment in Goodfellas, because all the waiter had done was annoy, and that was enough to die. So this is Joe Pesci as an older, if you like, wiser and more readily accessible person. He's not a squib, a firework anymore, but he's just as lethal. This is a film that split the critics and, if you like, Joe Public, because the critics are almost unanimous saying it is a great film. great film. Whereas the public have said, well, it's too long, it can be very dull, it can be boring, it can be tedious, it can be repetitive. So it's another of those films which splits the high-powered critics and the everyday punters, if you like. Interesting use of CGI techniques for making the main characters look 30 or 40 years younger, which some people have said is rather weird because it doesn't entirely work when you're talking about people's eyes and you want them to become young. We need to see, I think we need to see this film before we say too much more about it, because it's a film that covers mammoth topics: violence, betrayal, dishonesty, bankruptcy, high emotion. And people have said it's a massive achievement for Scorsese. But some of the people in public arena have said, well, it's another gangster film. We shall see, as we have said before.
I don't think there's anything wrong with another gangster film. And I absolutely love Goodfellas. I'll sort of say that that's one of my favourite, or probably my favourite ever film of that genre. So if this is a follow-up in any shape or form, yeah, I would love to see it. But I have to admit, I'm more likely to watch it on Netflix, because then you can pause it. And two hours of a film is sufficient for me, let alone 3.5.
Yeah. Yes. Well, one of the things I've heard about the, because I was talking to somebody yesterday about this, about the de-aging, isn't necessarily the facial, how they look, how their faces look, it's their actual physical movements.
The movement, yeah.
Because they're still 70.
Yes, it's not easy.
And they're supposed to be 40, 30 or 40.
Leaping up and down stairs.
They're still
example.
Walking around like 70 year olds. So
yes, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a film which people have said this is Scorsese's major achievement. But as Judy's just said, it can be just taken as a great entertainment. And there's nobody who said that the gangster films such as Goodfellas were boring. I think we ought to make our own minds up about this. I'm not going to say anything else about The Irishman, because it's had enormous publicity. The next film is Knives Out. Now, this, I was lucky enough to see when Jeremy and I were fortunate enough to go to some previews in Sheffield. Knives Out was one of the films which I was lucky enough to see. Now, Rian Johnson, I apologise for saying, is not somebody who I know very well, but Rian Johnson is the director of The Last Jedi, and he's moved from The Last Jedi to an Agatha Christie homage, which is very interesting. But not only has he directed it, he's written the entire film. And everybody says this is one of the wittiest, most interesting, complicated whodunits that has ever been seen. Because it features the classic Agatha Christie things. It features the Gothic house, the death early on, the many suspects and the interrogations. But people say, oh, it's just a copy of Agatha Christie then. No, it isn't just a copy of Agatha Christie, because Rian Johnson has subverted and made it fresh and chuckly. You're not going to sit there and guffaw with laughter, but it's very, very witty. A lot of one-liners. One of the characters, for example, is allergic to lying, and when she hears a lie or speaks a lie, she vomits. She can't stop herself from vomiting. So that's just one example of the way that he's sort of made it into a more quirky version. It's a drama with humour. It's not a comedy. So it's this rich family at the very beginning of the film in this huge house. And there is a body very early on. I don't think it would be a spoiler to say that Christopher Plummer is the body, but he will feature in the film as well. And he is a very successful mystery writer. And he's 85, and that was his birthday party on which he met his end. We don't know whether it was suicide or whether it was murder, But strangely enough, there is a private detective being employed by an unknown person. We don't know who has employed the private detective, Benoit Blanc, Daniel Craig. And people have said, wow, isn't it great to see Daniel Craig being funny? And he is funny. He plays this detective with a deep Southern Kentucky accent, and people make fun of him in the film. They say, oh, it's the CSI KFC guy again. And it's this sort of, these asides which make the film sort of worthwhile in every way. Nobody would know instantly who did it. And when you do find out who did it, I don't think you will be disappointed. Great film. Everybody loves it. You'd be a brave person to say that it's a rubbish film, because it is very, very popular.
It's a rubbish film. Oh, come on, I had to say that.
You had to say that, yeah.
Yeah, it's had amazing reviews. Absolutely amazing. Everybody seems to love it, from whatever persuasion or whatever
unanimously,
angle coming
which
from.
Which is so interesting.
Pretty much unanimously, yeah.
Yeah, public and critics. We see what people think about it, but...
Yeah, not just good reviews, just exceptional reviews.
Yeah. I think it's another one of these with a stellar cast, isn't it? It's as if everyone's turned up and everyone's sort of throwing themselves into it and obviously relishing the subject matter.
People say that, oh, well, you can imagine the Hollywood glitterati queuing up and saying, can I be in it, please? Can I be in it? Because it's such a well-written film and it's got so many clever one-liners. Yes, you've got Jamie Lee Curtis, who is the self-made daughter of Christopher Plummer, her dolt of a husband, Chris Evans, and then you've got Michael Shannon, a brother, Toni Collette, who is a sister-in-law. You've got so many people. So with all those people who are all suspects, there is a lot to watch.
It sounds like one I would actually like to go to see for fun.
Exactly.
Fun.
I know.
Fun.
We've got so many films for other reasons. Yeah. I would actually like to go and have a nice out for this.
Just entertainment. Yes. Indeed. It's the kind of film where you won't be sort of educated, except in as much as you'll be educated in how to write a great whodunit. And don't be put off by the fact that, oh, it's just a copy of Agatha Christie. It is so much more than that.
There's nothing wrong with a copy of Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie is the pinnacle of crime writing.
Apart from the fact that those sort of features are on television all the time, they've become a bit tired and jaded, and this has completely woken up the whole genre. Yeah.
That's not the fault of the original subject matter, though. It's the fault of the programmers who stick the same one on, like, once a week, every week for 3 years.
Yeah, and it is really interesting seeing Daniel Craig away from James Bond, just playing a part that he obviously enjoys. Mm-hmm. And I hope that you enjoy it if you watch it. And the last film from my point of view is Last Christmas. Now this has taken some stick from many
you
people.
Could say that, yes.
It has been hammered. People have said, "What garbage this film is!" You know, if you thought that Love Actually was a bit down market, this is a very, very poor imitation of Love Actually. Well, I'd like to just defend it a little, because I quite like the way that Emma Thompson writes and the way that she acts, although she overacts deliberately because she has that kind of character in this film. She plays the mother of Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones. I like Emilia Clarke in this kind of film. She's always lovable, and you find yourself sort of rooting for her, even though it's a corny story, and you've got London in its usual sparkly Hollywood Christmas version, and you think, oh, not again, but it carries through because apart from George Michael's list of songs, which are actually describing the plot, Heal the Pain, Move On, Freedom, Faith, Praying for Time, his songs are the storyline of the film. And it's good fun.
So which do you think came first? Do you think the plot's been sort of manipulated around the songs, or do you think someone's sort of written a sketchy plot and thought, actually, that song would fit in there? And
I think so that they've actually... Well, I did hear that the people concerned with the writing of it, not just Emma Thompson, but her assistants, did talk with George Michael before his sad death a while ago, and said, if we built a story around your songs, how would you feel? And he thought it was a great idea at the time, and this is the result. Now, you might say, well, it wasn't worth it, but I think it's going to be an enjoyable, a warm, feel-good film from director Paul Feig, who did Bridesmaids, I thought was a great film. This perhaps is not in the class of Bridesmaids, but it's worth a look.
Yeah, it has had some of the worst reviews I've seen in some time, and that's saying something. In fact, the director actually came out and with a really sweet message saying, okay, well, if you think this, that's fine, but we had a lot of fun doing it, and we hope somebody likes it. It was quite sad, really.
Paul Feig was read the Rolling Stones review, which was 1 star.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, you only gave us 1 star, but I hope it was a really glowing 1 star.
Yes, that's right. That's the one, yeah.
And I think that's the way you've got to look at it. Yeah. It's going to be corny and predictable, but you might just enjoy watching it.
It's basically a Richard Curtis film without Richard Curtis.
Well, his wit and his input.
I think, he's the only person that can get away with
perhaps
this.
Perhaps Emma Thompson is not really in the same league as Richard Curtis, although she's a clever writer.
I don't think it's really her sort of thing, though, is it?
Perhaps not. Worth a look.
It sounds very similar to Blinded by the Light. Did exactly the same thing for Springsteen songs.
Yeah.
And we have seen a good handful of those sort of films, haven't they, where they've actually used a given artist's songs as the narrative. And it sometimes worked and sometimes less so.
But mostly less so.
Do you think this is one of those films like, say, The Holiday, where the fact that it's based around Christmas will make people
and
sort
London,
of...
London, yes.
Yeah. They just sort of almost lower their expectations.
And I think people know Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones, but they know that she's been in other rom-com films and that people do like Emilia Clarke.
And people do like rom-coms. I mean, you can be as snooty as you like, but rom-coms are it is a popular genre.
Henry Golding, who is her boyfriend in the film from Crazy Rich Asians, he is new to me because I didn't see Crazy Rich Asians. But they say that Emilia Clarke and Henry Golding together almost carry it off, but it hasn't got the quality in its writing to go further than that.
I'm going to follow on from Steve's discussion of last Christmas with a handful of other Christmas films that are showing at Square Chapel at the moment. None of them are new, with the possible exception of Frozen 2, which is always going to be popular. It's always going to be wonderful. And I don't think we really need to say much about it. It will be one of the best children's films of the year. If it's anything like as popular as Frozen 1, it doesn't have much left to prove, to be honest. I love the characters, I love the storyline, and the music was amazing. The ones I want to talk about are sort of golden oldies, really. Firstly, It's a Wonderful Life. dates back to 1946, directed by Frank Capra and based on a book called The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern, who is not somebody I have ever heard of. It's gradually, over the last few years, turned into something of a classic, and Jeremy knows why it suddenly appeared on all our TV screens.
Yeah, well, it didn't do very well when it first came out. It was a real flop. And, in fact, it was such a flop that they didn't bother getting the rights, asking the TV companies for the rights. So the TV company showed it endlessly. People watched it on the TV and thought, oh, this is really good. This is a really good film. Why did we not like this to start with?
Well, apparently it didn't even break even. It didn't break its production cost until about 50 years after the event.
Apparently it was Jimmy Stewart's first film after he came back from the Navy as well.
Well, it was 1946, and it would have been.
Yeah, and he to start with, he didn't want to do it because he thought he was really rusty and he sort of forgotten how to act and he needed to get into it a bit more and he didn't want to do it. So,
but he is, as we presumably all know, and I've seen this film umpteen times, is wonderful. He plays George Bailey, who's sort of compassionate but frustrated businessman. Everything he tries to do doesn't come off, and he finally gets to the point of wanting to commit suicide on Christmas Eve, which is a very strange concept for your average Christmas story anyway. At this point, he is joined by a guardian angel called Clarence Oddbury, who's played by Henry Travers, who I'm not familiar with either. And he pretty much reruns his life without George Bailey in it. And that shows him what a huge difference it has made to loads of people's lives. He saved his brother from drowning as a boy. So many other people wouldn't have had homes without him lending them money, etc., etc., etc. So we have the inevitable Christmas reconciliation and the happy ending. So as Christmas stories go, it is a slightly unusual one, but I think it's one that people have got in the habit of watching on a regular basis.
It's black and white, but nobody cares because it's a great Christmas story. But I think the key element is James Stewart. I think James Stewart has this charisma, whether he's playing any part. People say, oh, it's James Stewart. Just as people say, oh, it's Cary Grant. They are playing, if you like, themselves. But they have this enormous, enormous magnetism. And James Stewart is a great lead man in this film.
Oh, he is. But I have to say, my favourite character is the guardian angel. I think he's the least likely angel ever.
That's
but
clever.
I think he's, it's really well done. If I had to guess how many times I'd seen this film, I'm probably heading up towards double figures. And I think it is one of those films that lends itself to that. And I think the same can be said of both the other ones I want to talk about in detail here. And one of them is Elf, which isn't quite as old as this. It's not quite such a classic. It dates back to 2003 and it stars Will Ferrell as Buddy, who is a human who was adopted and raised by Santa's elves at the North Pole. So obviously there's a bit of suspension of disbelief here.
Aww.
You've ruined it for us, Judy.
Sorry,
completely ruined it.
A bit of a spoiler
here. I
have
no idea.
No.
Anyway, he finds out that he isn't actually an elf and decides to go to New York to meet his real father.
Oh, no.
But I love Will Ferrell in this. I think sometimes it can be too slapstick for me, but just the look on his face, he does a very good adult innocent. And I think that is the best thing about this. And again, you sort of lose yourself in the plot. It is so ridiculous. But it doesn't matter. And one of the other things I think about this is it's very much a children's film. And I think children's films have to be a whole lot tighter than a lot of adult films. That children have a lot shorter attention spans, so that you're not going to get away with loose editing. Everything has to have a purpose. But also, your average child watches a film with adults present. So any children's film has to appeal to somebody from the age of, I don't know, 3 to 93, which means that, generally speaking, a lot of these films are if anything, higher quality than films aimed purely at adults, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know if you have anything to say about...
Yes. Although having said they have a short attention span, Frozen 2 is over 2 hours. Yeah. That's a very long film.
True. And Mary Poppins too, I noticed. Yeah. And another... I can't remember what else it was. I've seen another children's one here fairly recently.
The thing about Will Ferrell is that his size is so ridiculous in the elf costume that he has. It's just funny.
He is.
He does play quite straight as well.
Oh, absolutely. He's just all wide-eyed innocence and much less of the... Not quite so slapstick and not quite so... His adult slapstick I don't like.
It's not knowing. Yeah. He's completely
It does the innocent very, very well.
He just lets the plot do the work.
Yes.
True comedy has to be played straight. The moment you start winking at the audience and giving people sort of little asides, you think, oh, please don't do that. Just play it straight, and this is what Will Ferrell does.
So you're obviously a huge pantomime fan, Steve.
Talking to the wrong person, sorry.
Well, that has its place. I think it does have its place, but I think in this particular film, the playing it straight and playing it innocent is the right move. And I think the fact that we're still watching it 16 years on is a testament to that.
Yeah.
Okay. The other Christmas film I would like to talk about is The Grinch. And to be honest, I wasn't sure which version of The Grinch we were looking at. There have been two or three recently. Obviously, it's based on the Dr. Seuss book, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. There was an earlier one with Jim Carrey in costume. This one, as far as I know, the one that's showing here, as far as I know, is the animated one from 2018. But whatever, it is the same story. It's a Christmas story. It's about how the Grinch stole Christmas, and it's about how he gets his comeuppance, and finally he has his mind changed by a young girl's generosity of spirit. And to be honest, it doesn't much matter whether it's someone playing it. It doesn't much matter whether it's purely CGI or just animations. Both versions are very, very close to the book. And both versions work because it is a brilliant book. Obviously, it's another Christmas one. It's not one you're going to sort of watch after the event. It's not a new. It's not one you're going to be watching in January, but at every December, either of these versions of The Grinch, or probably both of them, will be on my TV with either just me watching or my grandchildren or whatever.
I would probably try to avoid it if it was Jim Carrey, because I think Jim Carrey to me is the sort of the antithesis of playing it straight. His face gurns and twists, and you think, oh, for goodness sake, Jim, just say the words.
This is a Grinch.
It is Dr. Zeus.
I know, but Jim Carrey is always.
He's not always. I think half the time he is and half the time he isn't. I loved him in The Mask, but hated him in Ace Ventura.
Presumably, because the newer film is the animated one. It's that one.
Yeah, I think so. That's the one that's the one that seems to be on the...
Yeah, that's the newest
On the Square Chapel listings, but it's all down to Dr. Seuss, and they do keep it, so long as they keep the rhythms of the words and the poetry, I think it's a success anyway.
Well, that's it for December's podcast. You can see all these films at the Square Chapel Centre for the Arts. We'll be back in January discussing things such as films such as 1917 and Little Women. So on behalf of everyone at the podcast, could we just wish you a very happy Christmas!
Fascinating stuff. Don't you dare. You asked me to say it.
I'm going to get past that now.
I feel
practiced.
I feel a prat saying it into an open space. I know, I'm not going to say anything. Oh dear. Okay. I'm not going to say fascinating stuff.
Ho, ho, ho.